Okay, so in this talk, I'm gonna talk about Spec Explorer and model-based testing as a technique. So I'm not gonna go very deep. I just wanna give the basics of what's the meaning of doing model-based testing, how Spec Explorer looks like, how's the general experience. This type of technique is being extensively used for designing test suites for protocols. So if you're interested in this after this talk, I really recommend you, if you can, attend to Simon's talk. I think that's on Wednesday, that he's going to talk about how they used MBT for testing SMB3, for designing test suites for SMB3. So to give you a little bit of a general background, so Spec Explorer started in Microsoft Research, I think like 5 years ago. And at some point, it moved out to become like an actual product. It's considered part of like the formal on the formal side of software engineering, but on the other hand, it's like a lightweight within that family. It's like a lightweight tool. So let me start and give you a very high-level idea of what's the meaning of doing model-based testing. So basically, you have a system. This is a general purpose tool, even though I think it makes particular sense for protocols, but it's a general purpose tool. And the idea is you have some requirements, and with requirements, I mean, let's say, testing requirements. So you have a system and you want to test it. So you start from the requirements, and from the requirements, you build a model, a behavioral model. And this is the step that distinguishes model-based testing from other more traditional ways of testing. That is, you build a formal model. You describe formally how your system behaves in terms of those testing requirements. And for that, you use a language. I'm going to show that later. So by formalizing this, the nice thing is that you already get feedback on your requirements. So usually when you write test cases using the traditional approach, if you're a tester, you already have some mental model of how your system behaves. You don't formalize it usually anywhere. You just start writing test cases, and you are, as you write the test cases, you encode what is the expected behavior of your system. So by building this formal model, you can very early in the testing stage, you can identify like contradictions, sub-specifications, a lot of problems that your requirements may have just by formalizing this. After you model this, you generate test cases. And again, this is unique in the and belongs to the model-based testing technique. That is, test cases are generated from the model. You don't write them manually. You just hit a button, and all the test cases are generated for you. Test cases basically have two parts. I mean, and this looks, I mean, after they're generated, you can think of them as a traditional test case. They have two parts. They have inputs, like test sequences. That is, that's the sequence that drives your system, and expected outputs, the test oracle. Both things are generated from your model, how you're going to drive your system and how your system should behave. So the test sequences control your implementation, and the expected outputs observe that implementation. And when you execute a test case, of course, you get a verdict. Either your test case passes or fails. So of course, once you get this verdict, that gives you feedback about your implementation. And that's what a test case is supposed to do. It tells you if your implementation is doing the right or the wrong thing. But this as well gives you feedback for other parts of your modeling stage. And for example, the verdict can tell you that your model maybe is wrong. Your model is another piece of code now. It can have bugs. Hopefully, it will have less bugs than your system because it's an abstracted version of your system. But you may also have introduced some bugs doing modeling. And it can also give you feedback about the requirements, right? Maybe the requirements were wrong. So this is, in a nutshell, what model-based testing is about. And I would say the outstanding edges in this process that belongs specifically to model-based testing are this authoring of a model, of a formal model, and this step about generating, right? Usually when you do traditional test cases, you just go directly from requirements to writing test cases. Any questions so far? Okay, so let me jump to a very simple example so I can give you like a first grasp of how the tool looks. And this is a stopwatch. We're trying to test a stopwatch. And this is a very simplified stopwatch. We don't care about the UI. We don't care about the numbers. We just care about these three buttons that a stopwatch has and how they behave in terms of the state of the display. So there is a start-stop button that basically changed the display mode from daytime to timer. So there are just two display modes. You can press this button at any time, right? And you change from date and time to timer and back to daytime. Then we have the reset lap, the start-stop button. And this is only available in timer mode, and it stops and starts the timer, right? It only works when the timer is displayed. And the last button is the reset lap timer. It's only available in timer mode as well. And when the timer is running, if you hit this button, it will freeze the timer. If you hit it again, it will unfreeze it, right? And when the timer is stopped, if you hit this button, it will reset the timer to zero, right? And that's the behavior of my system. So the rest of the stopwatch is going to be abstracted out. The only thing I'm going to care about is when these three buttons are enabled, some of them are always enabled, some others will not, and what's the effect of the interaction of these three buttons in terms of the timer, so when it's in daytime, when it's in timer mode, and when it's going to be stopped, right? So let me switch to the tool. So Spec Explorer ships as it's a power tool of Visual Studio. So you have Visual Studio, you can download Spec Explorer for free and you install it there. And if we look at the project, you will see basically three parts. There is the implementation, and that's the system I want to test, right? And in this case, it's all written in C Sharp. It's all part of this project. This doesn't necessarily need to be that the case. You can have your own system, and as long as you can wrap that into some adapters that can interact with your system, you can just expose the adapters here in the project. The other part is the model, this formal model that I said that it's part of the MBT technique, and then the test cases that you can generate. So let's start taking a look at the model. So the main idea here is that there are going to be some variables that's going to describe the state of my system. And since this is a very abstracted way of describing a stopwatch, these three variables are the ones that are going to control how my system looks like at any point in time. So there is a variable that tells me if I'm in display timer or in daytime mode. I'm going to have another one that tells me what is the mode of the timer. So a timer can be reset, running, or stopped. And this is sort of independent of the display timer mode, right? I can have the timer on any of those stages and decide to show the date and time. And a third variable that says is the timer is frozen or not. So that's the state of my system. All the interactions that I'm going to try to test are going to be in terms of those three things, three variables. The other thing I have in my model are rules, right? And rules describes how my system is going to evolve across time. So basically, I will have one rule representing each of the buttons of the system. Every time that I hit, for example, the mode button, that means that this rule is going to be executed. And the same for each of the buttons I have. So the main structure of this is you have the state of the system on one place, and then you have a set of rules that describe how your system can evolve. Each rule will probably, it may take parameters. Probably this is not going to be the case here because it's very simple. But it may take parameters, and it will interact with the state of the system. It will tell me how this rule affects the state of the system. So if you look at the mode button, this is very simple. I can always press this button. And every time I do it, I just flip the state of display timer. And that's the only thing it does. The start stop button has some condition. This button is only going to be enabled if I'm in display timer mode, right? So I'm setting the condition here that says only explore this rule. This rule is only going to be enabled if this holds, right? Otherwise, I don't care about this. And well, this is very simple. It just checks the timer mode. And if it's running, then it sets it to stop. And otherwise, it sets to running. And here, it takes care of the time frozen variable, and it sets it to false. If the timer mode was running, and I stop and I click this button, then the timer is frozen now. And the last rule I have is the reset lap button. And this is sort of similar. It's only available if display timer is set as the other rule. There is an additional condition here that says that I can only reset if this timer mode hasn't been reset yet. So if the timer mode is already reset, I don't care about this rule. And it does a similar thing. It checks what is the timer mode. And in terms of if it's running or not, it just updates the timer frozen variable. The last thing I have, and if you've observed all these rules we went through so far, they return void. So these are things that interact with the system, but I can't really know what's going on. They don't project any internal state of the system. The only rule that does that is this one that tells me if the timer is reset or not, right? That just projects the timer mode variable and checks if it's reset. So in terms of testing, the only thing I'm testing, and this is the way I decided to model it, is I'm just going to check if my system says that the timer is reset or not in the appropriate points in time. Considering all the possible interactions of the three buttons, I want to check if my system always responds in the right way in terms of if the timer is reset or not. So this is my model, right? This describes everything that my system is doing in terms of what I'm interested in testing, right? This is sort of an abstraction. So on one hand, I have this model. On the other hand, I have the implementation. What connects these two things is what is called the CORD file, the coordination file. And this is telling me how this model is going to be explored. So you can think of these machines as the entities that traverse the model, that crawls around all the possible states and transitions and returns me the result of the exploration of my model. So this first machine is just a very general one that says construct all the transitions that are possible from this model. So one thing I can do is I can go here, and this is a window that comes with the Spec Explorer package. It's the exploration manager, where I can see all the machines that I have defined. In this case, I can see this model machine that is here. So what I can do here is say explore. And as a result, what I get, and let me change the display state. What I get is all the possible states of my system. This machine that I just built is saying construct all the possible transitions that my system allows. So this is the result of the exploration. I'm starting from this initial state. And every time that I can successfully traverse one of the rules I define, I will see an edge. And two states are going to be different if the state of the variables I define as part of my model are different. So if by interacting with my system across different transitions, I get to a state that I had before, those states are going to be merged. So if they represent the same system state, I'm going to have the same state. And if there is a transition, that means that there is a rule that is enabled at that point that it can traverse to reach other states. So if you look here, I can always push the mode button because that rule doesn't have any restriction. So from any state, I can always click the mode button and jump to another state with where the display has flipped. So from daytime, I will go to timer and back to daytime. This other transition represents the is timer reset projection. And that doesn't change the state of my system. It's just a query to know how my system is doing. So you will see that there is always a loop that represents that action. That means you always end up in the same state that you started, because this thing is not really changing anything. So you will see that loop on every state. And the rest for the other two actions that are available. So you will see that, for example, if I'm in daytime, you won't see any start-stop button because I said that that action is not enabled when I'm in that mode. I will see that when I'm in timer mode. So for example, here, I can click the start-stop button. So now from reset, I go to running, right? And I keep the timer displayed mode. I can click on the mode button, and that means that from timer, I'm going to go to daytime, but my timer is going to still running on the background, right? So each of these states represent all the possible states of my system. And since this is a very, very simple state, I can see that, I mean, I have like, I think, 8 or 9 different states, and that's all. That's all I see. It's a finite model, the thing I built. So going back to the Exploration Manager, you will see that there is another machine that is the Test Suite machine. So let's go to the config core and see how this looks like. So you can think of this first machine as all the possible behaviors. My whole system behaves like that. This other machine is going to use that model for generating test cases. And what is a test case under this perspective? It's just a path across my system. So I'm going to start from the initial state. I'm going to traverse some transitions until I get to some end state. And that's going to be a test case for me. The actions in the test case are going to be defined in terms of all these transitions that I traverse it. Those are the ones that are going to drive my system. And on the other hand, I have some oracles. For example, in this example, is the isTimerReset function is the oracle. The model is telling me how that function should behave. So every time that I traverse that action, I can match what my system is doing against what my model is telling that the system should do. So this machine is telling, OK, construct test cases from this model with some initialization on the, to begin with. But we don't need to go deeper into this. So now I can go to the Exploration Manager, and I see this test case generator as another machine. And I can explore that as well. And as a result, what I get is a set of test cases, a test suite. And if you look at this, this is similar to this exploration. But the difference is that now what I have are just traversals of this model. So for example, this test case is, well, first I initialize, then I check if the timer is reset or not, and the model tells me that the system should answer true. Let me zoom in a little bit. Then I press the mode button. Then I check again what the timer should be. Then I click the start stop button. Then I check again what the state of the timer. I do similar actions until I get to this final state. And this is one test suite. The edges are telling me what are the actions that I'm doing on my system. And every time that I use a function that is supposed to return something, I'm going to compare that against my implementation. So once I've generated test cases, what I can do is I can generate this code. And this actually generates, this is C#, actually generates all these steps and checks against the system to see if the answers match what the model tells it should happen. So the nice thing about this is once you generated the test code, then that's code. You can think of that as the same thing that a tester could have written, right? You don't need a Spec Explorer anymore. You can just take your code somewhere else and run it against the system. And in fact, you can just go to the exploration window where you can see all the test cases. The test cases generate like the standard MS tests. So you could use whatever tool you want for executing the test cases. In this particular case, I'm using the Visual Studio window that just loads all the generated test cases. So here I can just, for example, I can execute this test case. And I just see it passed. I can go, I can select all of them and execute them. So in fact, this window that you're seeing is the implementation running, right? And so this the idea is that each of these steps, are being traversed by the test cases. And the results are being matched against the system. So let me open the test result screen. So here I see that from all the test cases that I have generated, some of them passed and some of them failed. So what I can do now is go to the failed test case. Here you can see what the test case was about. So here we logged everything that the transitions were doing. And here you can see that it says, well, I was expecting a false, but actually I get a true. So the model was saying, each time reset function at this point of the test case should have returned in a false, but actually our implementation returned in true. So that's a test case that failed. And I can actually go to the generated test case here. And this is how the generated test case looks like. You can see that it starts from the initial state, and then it executes all of the transitions. So I'm executing the initialized transition, then the isTimer reset, then the mode button, then the isTimer reset. And as you can see, every time that I execute this timer reset, there is an assert that we generated that basically compares the results from the model and from the system to see if they match. So this test case failed at some point, and this is the line, right? Here I was expecting a true and I got a false. So I'd actually get the point where this failed. So now, for example, I can go back to my implementation and see, well, maybe there's something wrong here. I can debug this and see what was going on. So let me go back to the solution manager. I'll go to the implementation. And here, there is a bug, right? So what I can do is I will just comment this out. I will go back to my test cases and observe that when I change my implementation, I don't need to re-explore my model or to regenerate the test cases. Those things were generated from the model, right, that I haven't changed. And the generated test cases are there. They are code. They're going to drive the implementation. So now I'm going to just change the implementation and rerun the test cases as they were generated in the first place. So here I'm running all the test cases. And since I removed this bug that I had, all the test cases should pass. That's it. OK, so any questions so far? I just wanted to give a super high-level view of this very simple model and how MBT can be used. Yeah.
Any other way to define a model, for example, except the writing in the C-sharp or whatever? Because sometimes you are have a model as a state diagram, for example, already in the UML. Or you can have an, you wrote a transition table. Mm-hmm. Because it's sometimes it's in the programming languages, it's hard to make this model correctly, even from the scratch. So it's easier to draw a transition table between every state, put the state possible states after transition, and to get the model from it. It would be nice to have.
You could use whatever. So what I'm showing here is C#. You could use whatever .NET language for expressing your model. So you could use Visual Basic or whatever thing that supports .NET. I think, but I don't think this has gone external. Maybe Yiming, by the way, he's the dev lead of Spec Explorer. I think we had an importer that takes sequence diagrams and generated a model out of that. But I don't know if that ever got shipped officially.
Yeah. We have an experimental feature importing a model from a sequence diagram, but we didn't finish it or make it RTM quality. I think state diagram is something that people also repeatedly asking for, but unfortunately we don't have anything for it yet, but I think it's very reasonable. But I think our experience showed that probably for certain cases, drawing a diagram is easier. But for our experience, for example, based on testing protocols, our tester really found that when the system is so complex and it's very difficult for you to draw a complete diagram for it, but rather sometimes you feel it's easier to model your system aspects by defining your state variable and defining the behavior which read and update the variable, so finally the tool generates a state diagram for you. But I think it's a very, very also a very useful feature to support a state diagram, but we don't have it yet.
Yeah, I think as a bootstrapping technique, it can be very useful. So maybe with a diagram, you don't have all the information of your system, but you could draw something, bootstrap to code, and maybe complete that with some other, probably more reserved variables or. But in terms of the transitions, probably you will cover most of them with your diagram.
Yeah, yes. It's this part, at least the import part, could be very useful. For example, you have a transition table between the states. You just fill the table, and it generates some skeleton code. You update it, and extend. Because initial bootstrap could be hard for people to model as in some programming language.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And continuing what Yiming was saying, I think that for the protocol world, if you are, for example, taking a look at the technical document, that is very similar to this code I'm showing, in the sense that you usually find things expressed in terms of the abstract data model. So you can probably map the abstract data model to the state here, and you can map all the messages that you're expecting in terms of rules here. So in terms of the TD, I think this approach is closer. But I agree that in a lot of other cases, probably a diagram is closer.
Another question, what's the limitation on the size of the model it's right now?
Yeah, well, that's something. That's something you can configure. So of course, there are hardware limitations. But in terms of logical limitations, you set bounds as part of the code file. You say how many states, what's the depth. You have several ways of setting bounds. But with this, I have a second example to show after this one. And it's an infinite model. And I think that's when the interesting part comes in. Because, of course, as you can imagine, a finite model by definition is not something that is likely to hit in a real case scenario. So one of the main problems, I guess, from this technique is that the state explosion is very easy to happen. So you very, very easily start having thousands of states, and that becomes unhandleable. So this tool provides ways for slicing data. So you focus on the family of behaviors that you're interested in. But I'm going to go there soon. Let me go back to the slides. OK, so going back to the technique, MBT as a technique, of course, there's pros and cons. On the good side, you have this push button test suit generation, right? Once you model that, and of course, modeling is not trivial sometimes. But once you have that formal model, you can just generate those cases. You have this early detection of requirement inconsistencies. And that's something that, I mean, you can argue that that's something you can do without MBT. But the process that MBT forces you to follow kind of forces you to find this inconsistency upfront, because it forces you to formalize what you want to test. And the other point that is, I think it's also a very nice thing to have, is that when your model changes, when your requirement changes or your code changes, it's much easier to update the behavior of your model. You just go to one place, you have this formal model there, you go to the line of code that changed, you change that, and you automatically can regenerate all the test cases. With the traditional approach, if there is some change, you need to go one by one all the test cases and first figure out if this was really affected or not by your change. And if that's the case, figure out when that exactly is happening. Since you have all consolidated into a formal model, usually it's much more easier to just go and change it. Of course, on the downside, you need more work in advance, right? You need to understand, you need some time to wrap your mind around this concept of building a formal model of the testing behavior of your system. That's something that maybe with the traditional approach, you didn't need that much. Of course, it depends on your system, but it's there. You have this mindset adjustment, and you might need to change some processes on how your testing works. So, of course, the question is MBT worth investment and when? So, of course, it's not always the case, but of course, we believe that, yes, it is worth the investment. And let me go through this slide. The idea is that with the traditional approach, you start with the spec, you write the adapter part, and with adapter, I mean usually you abstract what you want to test in some sort of common library that is the thing that you're really going to interact with, that is going to drive the system. And then you spend time test coding and running, right? And the last part is probably a significant part of your process. With the model-based test approach, you also have the spec study part, the requirement gathering part. You have this new modeling part that doesn't exist on the first approach. You also have the adapter coding that is similar, but you don't have test coding. You don't generate test cases manually. That's what you can infer directly. And of course, you have the running part. So we used model-based testing. We used this technique in the Windows Protocol Compliance project. And that was a huge documentation effort that Microsoft did I think it finished in 2008, 2009, where hundreds of protocols were documented. And this technique was used for checking if the documentation that we were generating was conforming with the technical, with how the protocol behaved, how the code behaved. It was sort of like an archaeological project in a way. And we heavily used this technique, not for all the protocols, but for many of them. And we finally found out that this technique save us 40% of our effort. So since this was a huge project, it saved 2,050 person years. So this was really, really a huge gain using this technique. And as I said before, we don't think that this can be used blindly for all type of projects. So we believe that MBT, or particular Spec Explorer, really pays off if you find some of these checkpoints. One is that the state that you're trying to model is potentially infinite, right? Usually when your system is small, it's easier to go with the traditional approach. It's easier for a tester to understand how the system should react. When the state is gross and it's infinite or very complex, when requirements can be covered in many different ways, or you have a lot of parameters combinations, the system is reactive, distributed, asynchronous, that's when MBT really shines. Because what we found is that it's very hard for a tester when all these conditions are there to really come up with interesting test cases. And it's very hard to get lost in these thousands of interactions that are taking place. So MBT is really good for designing very deep test cases where you can have a lot of interactions and the test case really takes a long time. And so you can control exactly how are you driving your system, taking into consideration all these different behaviors. So for relatively simple systems, probably this upfront investment that you need to do when you need to model and you need to understand how to formalize your requirements, it's probably too much, and you could go directly with the traditional approach. When the system becomes complex enough is where we think that this can really be used, because this upfront investment that is about modeling really pays off at the end when you generate as many test cases as you want. Because that's the other nice thing. Once you have the model, I can ask you, how many tests you want? 1,000? Millions? OK, I move the slider and push the button, right? So let me show you a little bit more complex example and more in the protocol domain. That is, I have a chat protocol there implemented. And of course, it's a very simplified version of a chat protocol. And the idea is that there is a single chat room, and users can log in and log out from that room. And once they are logged in, they can start sending messages. So users have an ID, where we'll be simplifying users as just an ID. Every time that something is sent to the chat room, the server acknowledges that. So every time that a user sends something, there is the server answering, yeah, I got that. And there are two or three very simple things that users can do. So they can request the list of log users, and the server answers that. And the users can send a message to the chat room, and all the users that are logged in that chat room will get the message. It's sort of a broadcast message. It's always a broadcast. So there is only one requirement. So there's not really a lot of requirements in terms of ordering. If multiple users send different messages, it's not really clear how other users will get that, in which order. There's no requirement about that. But it's one important requirement that it basically makes the chat thing work. That is, multiple messages from the same user should arrive in the same order, right? And that makes sense. If I'm chatting with someone, I don't want my messages to get in a different order. If there are multiple people chatting, well, I don't really know how each of these messages coming from different users will arrive in terms of ordering. But if I circumscribe that to a single user, the order should be maintained. So this is how the chat works. So let me open that in Spec Explorer. OK, so again, I have my implementation and my model here. The only difference here with respect to the stopwatch example is that the implementation of the stopwatch was directly written there, and there was no this adapter in the middle. Here, the testing behavior that I want from my system is abstracted in this adapter layer that just exposes some sort of API that I can interact with. And that API is going to drive the actual system. So here you will see this adapter code. So let's go. I'm going to quickly go through the model. I'm not going to go into much detail, but so you just get an idea of how this works. I have an enumeration that describes all the possible states of a user. A user can be, and in terms of the server act, right? So a user can be waiting for logon. That means the user tries to log on and is waiting for the server to respond. Can be logged on, can be waiting for a list command, and can be waiting for a log off. Those are all the states that a user can have. So I have my user class here that has the internal state of the user. That is one of the things. And I also have the messages that are waiting to be delivered. And that's basically a map that the key is the user that sent those messages. And the sequence of strings are all the messages that that same user sent that hasn't been delivered yet. Right? And that's all my user. So when a user is logged on, it will have a state and a map of messages to be delivered per user in the chat room. Right? And that's all. And the state of my whole system is going to be a map of users, the users that are logged in a particular moment in this chat room. Right? And that's all. Then I have a bunch of helper methods. I'm not going to go into those. Let me just go through one of these actions. So for example, this one. I have the action that represents a logon request. So now my action takes parameters. That's something new we didn't have in the stopwatch. So basically, this is saying a user ID, I'm representing users just with the IDs, is requesting a logon. So this action is not always enabled. The first thing I want to check is that this user is not logged on, right? So if the user is asking for to enter in the chat room, I want to check that the user is not there already. So that's the first thing. That's the only requirement. If it's not there, I will let him in. So here I'm creating a user, setting the state. Now the user is waiting for logon. I initialize this map that is going to be empty. And I add the user to the state of my system. So now the user is logged on. And on the other hand, I have the logon response. So the server needs to act that. So this is saying I'm doing an ACK on the logon response coming from this user. So again, this can't happen every time. The condition is that the user needs to be logged on, right? And the user needs to be waiting for logon. That means that every time that the server acts a logon response from this user, the condition is the user needs to be already in the chat room waiting for the server to do an ACK. That's the only condition. And then the user state is updated, and it's added to the map. And that's it. In the same way, I have actions for log off and for list. I won't go into much detail. And then I have the broadcast request and broadcast ACK. Again, I don't think there's a lot of surprising things there. I won't explain a lot. But let's go now to the exploration part. That's the interesting part. So now I have a lot of machines defined. We can go to the court file and take a look at that. Here. So again, I have this first machine. This is exactly the same we had for the stopwatch. That is basically constructing all the behavior of my system. It's saying, construct everything you can from this model. Now the main difference is that our model is infinite, right? So if I try to explore this machine, I will probably hit some bounds, right? So first observe that defining a machine that is inherently infinite, it's not a problem, right? It's not wrong. This is describing everything that my system can do. But that's right. My system has infinite number of states. That's what I have. The machines are explored in a lazy way, so that's not a problem. But anyway, we could try to, well, I didn't have that machine here. Let's see the second machine. So as you can tell, the problem is that now I have infinite states. It has no sense. It's pointless to explore that because first of all, I'm not going to have the whole model. The result of the exploration is not going to be the whole model. It's just going to be a part of that, because I'm sure I'm going to hit some bounds. So if I generate these cases out of that, I could. But I won't really be sure about what I'm really testing, right? What is the behavior that got into the result of that exploration, not what things were left out? I don't know, because I hit bounds. So these machines that I have here are trying to start slicing, restricting that to something that I can understand. Because of course, I'm not interested in testing everything. Since my model is infinite, maybe I can say, well, I'm not interested in all possible users trying to log in. I'm going to restrict the users to just one user. And I'm going to restrict all the messages that the user can send to message hi. So now I bounded the domains of my exploration. I'm just going to be interested in user 1 interacting with the chat room and in user sending hi as messages. And that's all. So here I'm saying, well, I'm restricting the domain in model program, which is the machine that explores the whole thing. And this is my new machine, a bound model program, which where these two things are restricted. So here I can go to bounded model program and explore it. So what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that now the model is infinite or finite? Observe that I restricted the domain. So the domain was inherently infinite because I have users that were just IDs, were integers. So that means any integer. And I could send any string I can. That's infinite by definition. Now I restricted that. But as you can see, well, I hit some bounds again, right? This is not really consumable by anybody. So here you can see all the possible interactions that my system allows. And of course, there are a lot. So what happened? It seems that this is huge still. Observe that. Since this is a protocol, it doesn't start and stops. It's always possible to continue interacting with the system. So even though I restricted these parameters, I can still, for example, do this. I can log into my system, and I'm user 1, so I'm allowed to. And then I can start sending hi, and then hi again, and then ask for a list request, and then say hi again, and then log off, and then log on, and send hi again. And that's allowed. So even though I restricted the domain, I can have an infinite interaction with the system because the system always accepts more requests. So there are more things I need to do to come up with something I can understand. And that's the purpose of the other machines. So let's take a look at these other things. OK, so this looks much more constrained. And this is using what is called a scenario. And you can think of a scenario in sort of regular expression-like language in which parameters can be omitted, and you have these stars or sequence commands that specify a shape of behavior that can be matched against your system. So this behavior is basically saying the first thing that should happen is a logon request from user 1. And then I'm going to wait for the logon response. Logon response has an ID, but I'm not passing that. I'm saying any logon response that is allowed, I'm going to take that. The same for user 2, the same for user 3. So at the end of this scenario, 3 users are logged, right, and got the ACK from the server. Then I'm going to say, well, then a list request can come. But I'm not going to specify any parameter. So any user could have sent this list request, and the server answered that. And after that, I get as many as log off request, log off response as I can. And that's the meaning of the star. That means, given the state of my system, I will accept all the log off requests that are possible. Right? And that's the scenario. 3 users being logged into the system, asking for a list request, any order, any user, I'm leaving some room there. And then users logging off. So this is sort of an abstract scenario. There's no system there. So what I'm going to do now, if I'm going to try to put together that against all the possible interactions that my system allows. And that's what this second machine does. This second machine is saying, synchronize this scenario against all the possible behaviors of my system. That means that, for example, here I was not specifying which logon response my server is ACK. So should be user 1 in terms of the model, but this scenario is not telling. But when I put these two things together, from all the possible logon responses that my sister allowed, I'm going to synchronize that against all the logon responses that my scenario accepts. So let's try to explore this and see how it looks like. Logon off list slice. It's this one. OK, so this is the result of putting together all these possible behaviors that my scenario allows together with all the behaviors that my system allows. So the result is this exploration graph. And as you can see, now I haven't hit any bounds. So I finally made this finite. And I'm sort of understanding what's going on, because this is about three users logging in, right, sending list requests, and then logging off. That's what this thing I'm trying to test is about. So when I put this together with my system, I get a logon request from one, a logon response from one, and my system set that one in the logon response. I didn't have that in my scenario. The same for two, the same for three. So at this stage, I have three users logged in my system. And then they can start sending list requests. I haven't specified exactly which one was doing what. That's my system, the one that is telling me that. So here I can see that there are three different options. User 1 can request the list, or user 2, or user 3, right? And that's non-deterministic. My system will allow any of those behaviors. But after the three of them ask for that and receive the response, now I merge into the same state again. And now user starts logging off. And again, I haven't specified exactly how that should happen. It can happen at any possible combination that my model, my main model, allows to. So I will see that, well, three logs off, then he gets the response, then two, then one, and here I don't have any more users. So this is representing all the possible ways in which users can log off. So now I can go back to my model, and I can, well, I don't have that as a test case generator. But I can put that, let me see, this was the logon of list slice. Here I don't want to go through all the details, but basically these combined slices is this logon off list slice, the one we just show, together with some other two main behaviors that I'm trying to test. So I'm putting everything together. And then I'm generating test cases out of that. So let's see how this machine looks like. So these are the test cases that are the result of traversing that exploration. And the first thing that you may notice is that with the stopwatch, all the test cases were just single branches. And now I have this undeterministic behavior, because now my system is non-deterministic, right? Now, for example, when a user sends a message, there's no requirement in terms of the order, for example. Only three users log in, and then they start logging off in some order. There are no requirements about that. So if you look at this test case, for example, these diamonds represent non-deterministic behavior. And now that's part of my test case. Because if my system allows non-deterministic behavior, that means that there can be multiple answers. All of them can be valid. And the test case, that the test code that I generate when I traverse this should allow that. When I invoke some action that can get multiple answers, I need to, to acknowledge that and accept all the answers that are valid. So this non-deterministic behavior is representing exactly that, that multiple things can happen. OK, I think the clock is showing some weird time. Okay, I have 2 minutes left, so I want. So I won't say much about that. Hopefully, you got an idea of how this whole thing about MBT works. And I think this chat example is particularly interesting, because it's asynchronous, it's non-deterministic. It's hard to test. If you need to think about writing this manually, it's not trivial. So I think this is a good example where if you invest some upfront effort in formalizing this, then you get a lot of payoff out of that. So any questions? Yep.
So what would be your approach into retrofitting this into existing systems? So imagine you have a large system. So how would you retrofit it?
Well, the test cases that this generates are regular MS tests. So
No. What I mean from the modeling point of view. You know what? To model.
You say you formalize your system.
Yeah.
And then?
In order to formalize the system,
yes.
Yeah, you have an existing system, right? To formalize it is a massive system, right? So how do you go to formalize it bit by bit? That's kind of what I'm going to.
Well, first, I think that you usually don't formalize the whole system, never, right? You're interested in a particular testing aspect of your system.
Exactly.
And I guess that it's the same process that a regular tester does when it writes test cases. The only difference is that informal model that the tester has in his head when he writes a test case, now you are being forced to formalize that with code.
Okay.
So it's sort of formalizing something that is already in your head,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's why I was saying that when you formalize that, finally, you can find inconsistencies, subspecifications in a more easier way, because you're sort of forced of putting what you think you have in your head on how the system should behave in code, in a formal way. And hopefully, if you abstract what you want to test in a nice way, it shouldn't be as complicated. Of course, you're just interested in abstracting behavior, right? You don't want to rewrite your system. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah.
More questions? Okay, so just to wrap up, as I said, you can download Spec Explorer from MSDN. There's documentation, and there's also, if you're interested in like a sort of deep dive, there's this very, very nice set of videos in Channel 9. I think it's like 10-hour, like a 10-hour course. I split it in, I think, like 6 or 7 lessons. And I really recommend that you take a look at that if you're interested in this technique. Okay, so thanks.